Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. Today, we're joined by Mark Moreland, a seasoned serial entrepreneur, investor, and mentor in the skill of patient accumulation of wealth. At the helm of Sky Method and Team Invest Australia, Mark leads a diverse community of over 10,000 years of collective knowledge, offering unparalleled insights into investing with discipline and patience. His career spans building and selling companies across continents and industries from marketing to private equity. It is a testament to his expertise in business and investing. An adventurer at heart, Mark's life outside the boardroom is as dynamic, from trekking in Nepal to racing on Finnish ice tracks. His mission is to empower individuals globally to achieve financial independence, leveraging the CI Methods analytics and the Conscious Investor Platform's success, which has already impacted a significant number of investors towards financial freedom. I've asked Mark to join us here today to share his story and how we can all work on mastering this valuable skill. So Mark, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Excellent. That's a very good introduction, Daryl. I hope I can live up to that.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah. Now the pressure's on. No, I'm kidding, of course. It's all good. But I like to always start off, before we get into business and investing, how did you even fall into this? Were your parents entrepreneurs and investors? Is this like a generational trait?
I was lucky that both my parents were in business, and that they always had an expectation that I was never going to do much from an academic point of view, and I would obviously end up in business to follow them. So that was very lucky. Because of that, I dropped out of school early. So I left in high school when I was 16 and started my first business. So I've literally had over 50 years in business. And I've only ever had a couple of jobs very early when I was a teenager, when I had to eat in between ventures, so to speak. So I was an early starter, and the advantage, there's pros and cons in that, of course, because one advantage is I started very early, which was in the school of hard knocks. So my experience was through trial and error and learning the hard way. And a lot of my friends who then went on to university and did degrees and so on, I was like 10 years out there in the markets before they got their first jobs. So there's advantage. But I also made a lot of, if I had a better education, I probably would have made less mistakes, perhaps.
It's a catch 22, isn't it?
Absolutely. And look, it is what it is. I can't go back. I can't go back now to change it, even if I wanted to. And my parents never drove me. Therefore, I just did whatever I wanted to do. So I started businesses when I was 10, doing things like digging out the lead from the shooting range and melting it down into ingots and selling it to the scrap metal people, things like that. Yeah, so I always had an entrepreneurial bent anyway. But as far as ending up in financial services and investing, that's only been the last 16 years of my career. So no, my parents had nothing to do with that either. My father was a builder and my mother had a model agency. So they're long gone, of course. And interestingly, from a business career point of view, I never had a plan, really. I was opportunistic in taking advantage of whatever was presented to me. And every time a door shut, another one always opened. So I had a serious business in my 20s that went broke. And I nearly went bankrupt. I didn't quite, but I did a composition, it was called, and did a deal with the creditors. And we lost our house. I had two young kids. It was all pretty, pretty grim. We had no money at all. But the thing was, though, literally the phone rang, and I got this fabulous opportunity to consult to a bank who thought, because I had a lot of expertise in direct marketing at the time, which I didn't really recognize as having a lot of value. And they offered me a consultancy gig and said, would I be interested? What do you think? So it was like back to races again. So each time one thing's led to another. And I've typically, from a career, I've started 9 major businesses over my career, sold a couple, most I ran down or moved on to something else. I wasn't really good at capitalizing on sales. Like these days, a lot of people, obviously, they set up a business, make it successful and sell it for a big payout. That never used to happen back in the days when I was young. Right. So we didn't think like that. So I basically would go, I'm bored with this business now. I want to do something new. There's a shiny object over there, so I'm now going to pursue that. And then I'd let the other ones die away. And so I do things differently now than what I did. Really, getting into finance was my most significant business I had was in credit card processing. And I had quite a few banks and international banks as clients. I had GE Capital in the US. Mainly Australian banks in Hong Kong and Korean banks. And we processed all the credit card transactions and also did all their loyalty programs management. And we did the first chip card loyalty program in the world in Hong Kong. And that was leading up to 99 when we had the dot-com crash. And I was listing the business in Hong Kong and I was about to get 100 million US. It was very exciting at the time. I was, and then the dot-com crash happened and it wiped out everything.
Oh my God.
So I found there's a lot of timing and luck in business as well. You've got to be in the right place and so on. But, you know, things can be, you can luck. I'd say I've been lucky, but in that case, I wasn't. So basically, I had to deal with HSBC and Hong Kong Telecom, and they all panicked and pulled the plug on the whole thing. Came back to Australia with my between my legs. But I had that business for 20 years. So that was the longest business from how long it lasted. And it only actually finally ran down a couple of years ago. But about 20 years ago, I was semi-retired. Retired's not my thing. I was looking for something new to do, and I moved to Sydney from Adelaide, which is a small place in Australia, and I met a guy called Howard who ultimately became my partner. And he'd had a successful business career as well. And basically, he suggested, why don't we use our business experience to evaluate companies as an investor and manage our money much more intelligently? And we both had decent-sized portfolios. And that's how Team Invest in Australia started, which was about 16 years ago.
Wow. So what would you recommend to people who are either starting out or struggling in their business right now? We've been through COVID. There's a lot happening geopolitically and economically. I think your story of maybe having kids and not being where you want to be might hit home for a lot of people. What would you recommend?
I think if you're young and you're an entrepreneur, I think focus is a really big thing. So I'd do one thing and not get distracted and do it really well. And obviously you need to commit and be disciplined. Things have changed a lot from when I started. It's actually much easier now to start a business because back in the old days, you used to buy very expensive computers, pay expensive rent. There was all you actually needed quite a lot of capital, even for a simple business. These days, it's very low barrier to entry. So that's the good news. So it's easy to get into it, but you know, it still takes it always takes longer than you think that it's going to take to actually get, even if you've got a good product or you've come up with an app or something and you think it's really good, you know, you can't just walk in and everyone goes, yeah, we're going to buy it and give you all this money. Yeah, it is always a hard slog. And like we set up a mutual fund about 10 years ago. And after about 4 years, we said, if we'd known what a pain in the ass it was going to be and all the regulatory bullshit we had to go through, if we knew all that, we never would have done it. Now it's established, it makes heaps of money, works really well for all our people who are in the fund, and we make massive performance fees. So it's funny with business. I've always found that it's like I regret it at the time on how much pain I'm going through, but then eventually you forget all the pain. It's probably like childbirth, if you can imagine what childbirth is like.
Childbirth and workouts. In the middle of a workout, yeah, I'm like, why do I do this to myself?
Forget about all the pain.
Yeah. I love that. So that's important. And I think we're all going to die anyways, as far as we know right now. And I think also even if you think about, some people believe we have an immortal soul. Some people think we're going to achieve immortality via technology. Some people believe in reincarnation, where we just live over and over again to learn lessons. No matter what you believe, we're talking about timelines of an immortal.
Yeah.
And on the timeline of an immortal, what would be the trophies that immortal would put on their mantle that they would prize? And I feel like in your story, you've already talked about some of these things. And it's not when things were easy and cushy in life. It was when I came through this adversity and then I did this thing, when I accomplished this amazing thing, when I almost made $100 million and I lost it, but I still found a way to persevere anyhow and end up where I wanted to be. I think that's an important lesson from it.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key things is I've been very lucky in that my wife, who has been with me all the way through, and I met her when I was about 19. So we've been married for 42 years and got grandchildren now. And she's always been a rock solid support for me all the way through whenever we've had our woes. We had plenty of woes in business. So I think choosing your partner is a really important thing. Yes. And then obviously take it seriously. Having a successful partnership with someone, I think, underpins what you can do in business. It's very hard to have a dysfunctional family and do well in business. I don't think it works.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I'm in the Philippines right now, and one of the things that I admire the most about this culture is they have incredibly strong family ties. That family here is huge, and they have huge family. My wife, her dad has, he's one of six, and her mom is one of nine. And my daughter's got 17 grandmas. It's just insane. And everybody's got, everyone's graduating from the bar or passed the bar exam or having a birthday. And there's a real, in some ways it's maybe a bit of nepotism, but on the other hand, it's an incredibly supportive family where there's room for you to go and pursue. And there's, I don't want to say a safety net, but it's not.
Oh, absolutely. It's a support structure.
There you go. That's, yeah.
In my case, my wife is Greek, and she came out to Australia when she was two. So she's more Australian. She's an Aussie rather than being a right. Greek, with Greek heritage. And same thing. She was one of eight. I was an only child.
Yeah.
And then by the time we had children, there was at one stage, I remember we had a Christmas and Greek Easter and so on, and there was 22 kids under 4 years old. But same. But I agree with you. I mean, that whole, the family and the strength of the family and the community is fantastic. And I've been very, I'd say blessed. It's probably the word. I'm not a religious person,
sure.
But I've got three kids, two grandchildren at the moment, but I'm going to have more. They're on their way. And all the kids all get on really well together. They all support each other. We've got a very strong family. It's fantastic.
That's such a blessing. Really, it's money alone. Yeah. That's part of what it caused me. I retired early. I've traveled the world. And there's so many places that I went to that I was like, man, it'd be great if I had someone to share this with. And that's part of the problem is it's great if you make it, but you want to bring everyone else with you. And
absolutely.
It's a booby prize to just get there on your own. And I think that's really, wholeheartedly. So what are some of the skills looking back and even forward as your career, obviously is lots of room, lots of runway ahead of you, but just looking at the past and looking to the future, what are some of the specific skills or behaviors that you think are important to improve or develop?
Well, the things that worked for me was I was very much a fake it till you make it person. The amount of bullshit I managed to sell in my businesses early, when I think back on now, it makes me cringe just about. But I remember when I got into the first bank, the bank program, I'd had a direct marketing agency. And I had a position in the market that was perceived to be an expert in direct marketing. Direct marketing is like the original roots of what we do now with AdWords and everything. It's really gone full circle. But I remember I presented to MasterCard, and basically Visa had come out with the first loyalty program on a credit card. And I went and presented to MasterCard to tell them how screwed they were and what Visa was going to do with this and how it was going to hurt them. And they, at that point, hadn't really worried about it. So I managed to pank them to the degree that they ended up putting me on a retainer of $50,000 a month. This is 30 years ago, to help develop products for them for the banks. So then I became sponsored by MasterCard. So when I went to see a bank, MasterCard introduced me to the bank as their expert. So the banks then all assumed that MasterCard had done all this due diligence on us, which they never did. And we must be totally safe and solid. So nobody did any due diligence. So I then presented a whole pack of slides showing them what our software did, and the software didn't even exist. So basically what we did is we got them all to pay to tailor it to their situation and the payments they paid for me to get it all written. So a lot of it, I think, is if you can be confident, you've got to deliver at the end. Obviously, I did deliver.
Right.
So it wasn't fake, but it was very much a massive exaggeration on what I could do, and I managed to get away with it.
But Elon Musk, I love this example because I always talk about how Elon Musk, I'm just going to say, made $300 million US. Again, Elon Musk made $300 million US selling a car. He had no factory to build and no team to make. He made a minimum viable product and he took $1,000 down payments and made $300 million in down payments for a car he had no factory to build and no team to make. I love that so much because he proved there was demand. He made a legitimate offer. Hey, it's just a down payment. It's fully refundable. It was the prepayment on future payments. And I just love, and even what you talked about, that's like what you did.
Yeah.
Can you, for people here, I feel like you're dancing around that you had this superpower feather in your cap, so to speak. And I think it would behoove us to not shine some light on this for the audience here. What is direct marketing? And how? What are the fundamentals of doing it?
Okay, well, just before we do that, just on Elon Musk, I think he's a genius. And I read the autobiography by Walter Isaacs, I think it is. He wrote, I recommend everybody reads that because it actually goes through how he thinks and the way he applies engineering principles, but the way he's focused and driven. Now, he's on the spectrum somewhere, so he's got an advantage over ordinary mortals like us, but it's absolutely mind-blowing what he's done. Anyway, getting back to direct marketing. Well, direct marketing in the old days used to be mail order primarily, and things like drop cards and all sorts of stuff, which is in the electronic, through the internet and so on. That's morphed now into, it was always accountable. So you had a situation where you could actually work out, if I spend a dollar, what was my return? So it was very anti-advertising agencies in those days were selling brand building, which was great because brand building meant you could do really expensive commercials, have a lot of fun, and make lots of money without having any accountability.
Oh, yeah. So you're just smoking weed and doing creative things.
That's right. We were always selling against that. The funny thing was, even though we could demonstrate and deliver cost-effective results, we still only got about a tenth of the budgets. Because the clients all liked it too. They would go off on the shoots in the exotic places and have fun and drink champagne. And it was like, so there was a real, it was the agencies and the clients, particularly in institutional clients and corporates, so on. And even though I could demonstrate that they'd be far better off spending a lot more money with us, they didn't want to do it because they'd miss out on all the fun. What motivates who you're selling to? And a lot of the time, if you're dealing with corporate clients, the people who are the decision makers, you've got to look at what turns them on. And you can't assume that their priority or their incentive is to make money for the business or to make that successful. They're much more interested in what's in it for them. But I don't mean that in a nefarious way. It's that things like that. So if they'll do things they enjoy over things that would be better for the business, so to speak. So yeah. It's a lot about understanding who you're selling to and what their motives are and what turns them on. And if you can then provide, that's much more important than the argument of this is going to be great for the business.
But now we're in an era of digital marketing, which is almost exclusively direct marketing to a phenomenal degree.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the principles? Like how, what are some of the timeless principles? Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover it all.
They're timeless because they haven't changed one little bit from back in when I was a teenager and started in that. Is obviously it's working out who your target market is, who you're actually trying to sell to. And the more you narrow it down, you need niches. And as I say, there's the profits are in the niches or niches.
They're riches and niches, bitches. That's, yeah, they're riches and niches, bitches.
And that's absolutely true, but it's hard to get. Often people struggle because they think, oh, but all these other people I can sell to. And it's very difficult to say no. I learned fairly early, and it was lucky for me, that it was better to say no to a lot of people. So rather than going, they want to buy my services, but I knew they really weren't the right type of, it wasn't going to extend my business, or if anything, it was a distraction because they would say, we want these changes made to the product or whatever, and it distracts you from what the main game is. So you really do need to be strong and say no. And interestingly, another big thing I learned was pricing is a really important part of how profitable your business is. And most people think you want to be cheaper than competitors, or you need sharp offers and discounts and all the rest of it. And that's totally wrong. You're far better off to come up with a value proposition which you can charge a premium for and make it a lot bigger. You want to make it bigger to the point where people go, hang on, what's going on here? How can you be that expensive? Because if you're just a bit more expensive, they'll chisel you and go, why are you more expensive than X? Why would we pay you this for your software when I can get it for $200 cheaper or $500? Make it five times the price. You make it five times the price and they go, what's going on here? Why is that? And the automatic assumption is that people, I think, intuitively think, obviously you're different. And in Australia, for instance, with Team Invest, we help people to identify their ideal companies to invest in their portfolio with an objective of getting 20% compound over time. So it's over 5 and 10 years. So long-term average is not short-term gains. Now, in that, we started off with software. We've got very good software. It's called Conscious Investor, which we used to sell for about $4,000, which at the time, $4,000 was expensive. And other software that I said was as good as ours, but it wasn't, but it was $2,000. So people would go, why should I pay you extra for yours? So it took it didn't take us more than 2 or 3 years to shift the price up where we charged $12,900 to join. So that's a upfront, and then $10,000 a year for the program. Now, what it meant was that we shifted up the curve on who we were selling to. Now, obviously, someone who's got no money or they've got $100,000 can't afford us. So our target market's people that have $1 million or more to invest, or at least $500,000 anyway, in Australia. And we started making much more money. And it wasn't, I found it no harder to sell the same product at a higher price. Obviously, the target audience had to be able to afford it. Then it made no difference to the conversions. I'd still sell 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 people I spoke to, whether I was selling it for $2,000 or $10,000, made no difference. Made a massive difference to what the profitability of the business was.
Yeah.
And it really did.
I think this is a really important point, because if the only differentiator between you and someone else is price, there's nothing stopping a new competitor entering the marketplace, even if they're suicidal. And if your only big differentiator is price, they might be suicidal, but they'll be in business long enough to upset your apple cart. Whereas if you charge a premium price, there's enough margin in there that you can have wiggle room to continue to over-deliver and innovate to stay at the top of the field.
That's right. The interesting thing that happened too is we thought long and hard about having a joining fee. Now, the joining fee sounds terrible. You say, why would you pay a joining fee? And basically, we treated it like the golf club analogy. We made it exclusive. And that, you know, to get in, you have to pay a premium. Now, people pushed back on it, and it cost me lots of sales. But what it did was it meant that the people who joined then took this very seriously. They thought, I've invested significant money in this. I've got to make this work, you know, for my own sake, versus the alternative, which would be, look, just pay monthly, and anytime you don't like it, you don't have to pay anymore, because that's what people do who are weak. And then what happened is those people they won't invest the time and effort which is needed to make it work for them to get the results. There's no free lunch here. What we have is a really good system of tools. You still got to work. And what I found is they would last 2 years before they would consider, like they would say, oh, I can't leave for a couple of years because I've invested too much. I need to make this work. Right. And then by the time 2 years, they've learned all the theory, they understand the processes, and they're totally engaged. And then our retention rate, by the way, is 98%.
Which is
so
huge.
We lose 2% of our members a year, we lose at that kind of rate.
Yeah, it almost sounds like you're not selling it hard enough. This is something that a mentor was telling me. I was telling my refund rate, and he goes, Daryl, your refund rate is terrible. And I said, what do you mean? My refund rate is great. And he goes, no, you're not selling it hard enough. You want some refunds because you want it to be easy for people to transact with you. You want people to try it, and it's not quite the fit you want. And I got in trouble because my refund rate was too. Now your retention is over 2 years, but I just thought it just reminded me of this. I thought I'd bring it up. That having no refunds is not a sign of goodness. It's a sign that you're not marketing and selling as hard as you should be, because you do want some, not because the product is bad, but because you're getting people to try it. And And again, this is refunds. It's not retention.
Yeah.
It just triggered it in my mind that you want people to be test driving it, and you want it to be easy and not see the refunds as a personal attack or anything like that. It's powerful. Sorry. So if someone's completely brand new to direct marketing, we talked about your marketing has to be accountable, meaning you have to be able to measure and know if you spend $1, what's the ROI. You have to understand what motivates people you're selling to. You have to know who's your target market. You have to advertise in niches. There are riches and niches, bitches. Yeah. You want to charge a premium. You want to charge a premium so you can offer.
So you've got to choose your niche, that niches that are going to give you the capacity for the people to pay the premium.
Right.
Yeah. And I learned this very early in direct marketing as well, was that you don't make up with volume at low prices compared to less people at high prices.
Right.
Yeah. You're way better off doing that. I just think I would never do a business strategy now that was cheap. In other words, something that says, oh, we're going to sell XY for really low price and get tens of thousands of subscribers. That would send a chill down my spine as far as the amount of work it would be to do that, versus saying, I'm going to sell this premium product and I'm going to justify the value for this and I'm going to target it really well. And the target audience that I'm trying to get is 1,000 or something to pay a lot higher price. Way more exciting than volume and low price.
I think that's powerful, especially because we already talked about him, not to fanboy, but on Elon. He started with an overpriced roadster that he sold to his rich buddies to validate proof of concept. And now he's got the $30,000 model now that he's got economies of scale and his team's worked it, and they've worked out all the kinks.
And well, the reason he's dropped prices now and so on is now because, as you said, he's got scale, but he's also taking advantage of government incentives and where the thresholds are on EVs. He's got to play all that now. It's a much harder game now for him. But I'm less excited about Tesla cars than what he's doing with the autonomous driving. And I think if he can nail that, I think he's likely to be the first to really nail it. Then what will happen is all the other car companies will give up on doing their own, and they'll all use Tesla technology, and that's going to be like a massive market compared to what he makes out of selling cars.
Yeah. So just to speak to that, is there your auto driving car service is the most advanced by far of any AI on the planet, because everyone's all excited about GPT and these LLMs, but his is navigating physical space at high velocities with lives on the line. And now that he's launched Grok, I'm really hopeful that he is as authentic as he comes across as for the people, because otherwise we'll all be plugging into a matrix.
I think he'll be the first trillionaire. Yeah, by the way. Well, he's the richest person in the world now, but I think he'll be...
In public. Even Elon said this. He said, you're not rich until you can afford your own legion. There's people that are making so much money from oil, all these families and stuff like that. You're not even allowed to speak their name. That's a real thing. There's actually a book. I'm sorry, I'm going there. But there's actually a book on the CIA.gov website called Bloodlines of the Illuminati.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, it's the you just go CIA.gov in any search engine and then space, and you type in Bloodlines Illuminati. There's a book listed on the CIA website talking about bloodlines. So there's real, but he's rich. He's the richest, publicly richest person we can talk about. We'll put it that way. So this has been a great hit list. Now, what are some of the greatest mistakes that you see your clients and other entrepreneurs making?
Mistakes. I'm now focused on investing, remember? So yeah, that's where I'm at. So what we have is in Australia, we have 600 members that are paying that kind of price, and they work in teams. So what we do is we have a collaboration. So we have very good software, which was developed 22 years ago. We bought it originally. It was developed by a professor of maths finance who studied Buffett for 20 years and reverse engineered everything he did and turned it into this excellent rules-based system, which is designed to mimic how Buffett reviews and analyzes companies. It's called Conscious Investor. So we bought that 16 years ago, and it had been operating in the US for the first 10 years, but we've actually got 22 years of history, and it works. And what it does is it replicates what Buffett does if you follow his rules. And that's done 18.2% average for 22 years. That's the average. And just by the way, for people don't understand compounding, it's a very difficult concept to get your head around. It's exponential curves. You know, we've got exponential curves in AI and just about every area of development now. We are an exponential. The brain can't deal with that. We all think linearly. And the thing with compounding is if you get 15% per year average for 10 years, you have your capital goes up four times. If you get 20%, it goes up six times. So if you have 100,000, it's 600,000, and then it's 3.6 million, and then it's 6, 12, 18, 20 million, roughly, after that on 30 years. So what it does do is it proves that even with relatively small capital, if you can compound it at an average rate of 15 to 20%, which is absolutely achievable, you can absolutely set yourself up. And one of the things from a business point of view, and I was talking to Daryl about this before the call, was one of the mistakes I made was not actually allocating a component of what I was making in business and investing it long-term to develop passive income. So that's the big thing. I was always good at making money, and my lifestyle tended to match my income and businesses. And I had my first Porsche when I was 23, and boats, Porsche, cars, done the whole lot. I haven't done planes and jets, but I've done everything else. And okay, I had a good time. But the smart move, whatever you're doing, whether it's in business or whether you're working, is to allocate 10%, 5%. It doesn't really matter what the amount is, but a fixed amount of money off on what you earn and take it out first. So you don't say, I'll invest what's left after I pay all my expenses and living costs, because there'll never be anything. And the power of that is what I was just saying. So you then learn how to invest it. And by the way, you can run index funds and so on. It still works. We do a lot better than that. But Buffett says, if you want to be a know-nothing investor, put your money into an index fund. Because if you do the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, you get 10, 12% compound return. That still works. We want 20%, but that's a bit of effort to do that. But anyway, you can learn that. It's absolutely learnable. And And what you do is you put that in regularly so that by the time you're 20 years older, because I look at the last 20 years, I'm 68 at the moment now, and the last 20 years have just gone by like that. It's just poof. And hopefully I'll be around for another 20 or 30 years. I'm working hard on the longevity thing. My wife is. So she wants to keep me around so that I'm still working functionally and making money and looking after her and the grandchildren and everyone when I'm 100. We shall see. But I might have another 30 years if I'm lucky. I'm into longevity. But it goes very quickly. So the 10 years, if you do the 20% compounding each 10 years, I'll tell you what, it's just awesome. And what it means is, for me, I've always taken the view of what's wealth. I've always been in business, but really what's important is passive income. And if you can develop it, so you have income streams coming in, whether they're from businesses, but preferably where you don't have to do anything. So like passive income in the stock market or real estate works as well. But if you can have that income coming in at double what your total cost of living, the lifestyle you want to live and enjoy is, that's security. That's financial security. It's FU money, really, because you can do whatever you like. And I think the big thing about having as much money as you need, double that, which gives you insurance and security and be able to deal with anything, it means you can literally live the life you want, do what you want when you want. And isn't that what it's all about?
Yeah.
So it's about money. It's about passive income, in my view. That's what we try and do. So we help people to build up that passive income, and it just gets higher and higher relative to what you're necessarily earning. And it gets to the stage where I've got people who've had jobs, as in working for wages, that have built $10 million passive, which then they have $10 million invested, and then they get, if they're getting 20%, let's say 10% on it, that's $1 million a year.
And there's
without them having to go to work.
Yeah. Which sounds...
They can go and sit on an island under the palms.
For those that can't see, he's talking about my background, because my original vision when I came to Philippines, because I made some money and retired early, was to buy an island and go to town once a week with my hovercraft. So that's powerful. So you talk about, first, there's the S&P 500. Real estate works as well. But there's better strategies. Now, what is a better strategy?
If you're looking from my perspective, now, obviously, we are, as I've always learned, we're focused. Charlie Munger, who recently died, who was Buffett's partner, he said, you need rules in investing. And by the way, there's a book called Poor Charlie's Almanac.
It's such a good book. It's
He updated it just before he died. So there's a new version, and I recommend it to anybody who's interested in investing or in a business, but it's also life lessons. He was a genius and sorely missed. But what he said is you need rules. So whatever you do, like whether you're going to be investing in real estate or whatever, you don't say I'm investing in real estate. You've got to invest in a specific part of that market because you can't possibly understand it. If you're doing residential, there's models that work. If you learn them, where you can replicate and build a portfolio. In our case, what we do is we invest in Buffett-like companies. In other words, companies where they're what we call wealth winners, which are companies that are going to be long-term capital compounders. That's what we look. So we only want to invest in very high-quality business with very trustworthy management. And we use our teams of people to review them and go through. So we have software first. So software narrows the market down to the companies that meet Buffett's criteria, and that's basically what we work with. So in the US, for instance, there's about 7,000 listed companies. There's about 300 companies that pass our base filters. And that's, so we forget all the rest. So cancel the other 6,700 companies and just focus on the ones that we think Buffett would like based on all of his metrics. And then those ones we look at to decide, do we trust the management? Do they have skin in the game? We love founders. So we've got founder CEOs, like Musk is a founder CEO extraordinaire. Bezos was, Gates, all fabulously successful founders. Personally, I basically won't invest in a company now unless the founders still, well, there's a founder mentality in the company. So because they're going to be much more likely to meet your expectations and they're not going to make stupid mistakes.
Yeah. I often feel there's the founders and then there's the builders and the managers and not to throw anyone under the bus, but often company will make it big and then the lawyers and accountants move in and they want to stabilize things and they do that and they can bring scale. But if things in the market change, look at Blockbuster and Netflix, right? Blockbuster could have bought Netflix. Blockbuster was doing $6 billion a year. They could have hired any talent, built any technology, and they got ran into bankruptcy by Netflix because they lost contact with the market. They The founders built it. They had a vision, and then the managers and the accountants and lawyers came in. They expanded it. They protected it. And as long as that train was going to go straight on the track, it would have kept running. But the problem was, is the market pivoted. And then everyone's running in circles like chickens with their head cut off because they're disconnected.
And there's a great book called The Innovator's Dilemma, which is about that. And basically what it shows, talks about is how corporates, particularly, and particularly if you're a dominant market leader, you cannot change and embrace the new technology because you've got to be willing to destroy your own business. Nobody's going to do it.
Yeah.
The innovator comes in, innovate, and eventually takes it away from them. The Kodak cameras, they developed the digital camera, tried to bury it because they thought it was going to destroy their film business. And of course, it did destroy the film business.
Yeah, because they wouldn't innovate.
Yeah, that's right. So that's true. And by the way, it's interesting with Buffett now, with his biggest investments in Apple, he's got, I think it's $460 million worth of Apple. It's about 47% of his listed portfolio is in Apple. And he said recently, I go to the AGMs every year, and in Omaha, and he said last AGM that Apple was the single best company they had in their portfolio. Well, there was no better business than Apple.
Wow.
And I'm an Apple shareholder too, by the way, so I've been for about 10 years, and it's been great. So we like technology as well, and I'm invested in stocks like NVIDIA, which has obviously been a massive glamour stock, but a glamour stock in a good way, in that its earnings last year grew by over 260% last year. And it's riding the wave, is capturing about 80% of the chip market for AI and so on. And that's going to continue for some time. So we like investing in technology as well, but not in technology where they don't have earnings. So we're not interested. Apple, great. Microsoft, they're all good. NVIDIA is fantastic. But yeah, they've got to make money. So they're going to be profitable, and it has to be sustainable. And the challenge is to not chase what the media says and what Wall Street says, because 90% of what Wall Street says is to help them make money. And if you make any money, that's great. That's a bonus, but no one really cares because it's all about them.
It's all pump and dump. They use the media to hype up something, and they just go, it's yin yang. They tell everyone to buy while they're selling. They tell everyone to sell while they're buying. And they just, everyone's like on this yo string. If you look, want to talk about phenomenons like Roaring Kitty, this guy was a values-based inventor, did exactly what you talked about, tried to find real companies that were worth real value, and got into the nuts and bolts of what was happening with management on the ground floor and what was the vision and plan for the company. And he found a stock that he loved. And they almost wiped out all the hedge funds that had just been enjoying this fat cat backroom boys club media saves our butt if needed, because they'll dissuade the retail market to go the opposite of what we need to save our asses because we made a bad call. And GameStop was I love it. I'm such a fan of that values-based investing.
Yeah. The GameSpot, the movie on that is worth watching, by the way, because the psychology of it all is really interesting. I'm not sure it was called, but it was on Netflix, I think.
Yeah, no, I've seen the pop-ups. I'm gonna watch that. So I have two kind of questions. One, you mentioned technology companies, real estate, kind of indexes. Do you find over the years that these are certain categories? Obviously,
I'm focused on listed shares. So we've done private equity as well, and we listed a private equity company in Australia, so it's public now, and that was successful too. So you can make money everywhere. For me, why I like equities is they're very liquid. Real estate is not liquid, and it also has a lot of frictional costs. The commissions, buying, there's big spreads on the difference between buying and selling. So you really need to take a long-term view on real estate. Now, that's an advantage where people do well on real estate because they can leverage it, and because it's more stable. Because it's less liquid, it seems to be more stable going forward over time. But real estate's fine, but it's not what I do. We do listed equities. The advantage with the listed equities are that obviously if you want to sell something, all you do is hit a button and you sell it. Now, the problem with that is it encourages people to trade. And there's absolutely heaps of evidence to prove that the more you trade, the less you make. And all it does is basically enrich the brokers. So it's all about being patient. Now, there's certain characteristics you need if you want to be a really successful investor in equities. And I would argue that you need to develop these over time. And I'm a lot better than I used to be, but I'm still pretty poor. Like, I'm not Buffett. Buffett is a bit of a freak. And it's not that you can't replicate what he does. You can rationally look at it and say, yeah, I can see what he does, but he's very patient. And as he said, he's willing to wait forever to invest to buy a particular company, meaning he won't invest in it until he can buy it at a price that's going to give him the return he wants. So right. He'll wait forever. That's hard. So I'm not that patient. So what we do is we use our filters to show only the companies that have all the strong financials. So that helps because we're not then distracted by the garbage and the story stocks. And then from there, we put them through the ringer and we use our network of members and their connections and experience, which helps to put color on. So in a lot of cases, we know more, I think, about companies we invest in than any of the investment banks, brokers or analysts, because we've got a lot more brain, much more brain power going into it, and it's done over time. So we develop relationships with the companies, and really what we want to do, the ideal is that we invest in a company like, I've been in Apple for 10 years. I would be very surprised if I don't still own my Apple shares in 10 years into the future. And that's what we want.
Right.
Because the return on Apple for me has been over 14% a year compound. And the right. reason it's so high is because I bought it when it was cheap.
Yeah.
You know, sold it. So that's the thing. And people don't realize what it means. And I've got companies now that I'm invested in that are growing at 10% a year. So not massive, but solid and very consistently. And I'm returning over 100% a year on what I pay for them, because I bought them when they were cents and,
right.
and now they're dollars.
Yeah, when there's blood in the streets.
They're paying dividends that are more than what I paid for the whole stock originally.
Yeah.
And that's what good looks like. And you get that and it's very relaxing. So you can be very lazy.
Yep.
This is not high effort type of investing. You do need to put some effort into understanding what you're investing in, obviously, and then you need to be patient to buy it at a price that can give you the returns. And we teach everyone how to do that.
Right.
So it's interesting because when you contacted me, we're just in the stage now of with CI Method in setting that up internationally. So we're basically replicating what we've done in Australia on a global basis. We're at 49 countries, but we're at the beta stage at the moment, so we're not actually selling anything outside the US. So if anyone who is watching, or you have your subscribers who actually are interested in having a look at what we do, we'd have no problem in giving access to all our software and so on for a while, for a few months or something, because we want to get some users happening. And then with the view down the road, we'll then sell the services. So just by the way.
Sure. So if people want to find out more, if they want to go check that out, where do they go?
Just go to cimethod.com, cimethod, one word, .com, and then just hit apply. So apply doesn't mean you're buying anything. And then what it'll do is it'll give you some information and tell you about it. And then if you just mention that you saw us through Daryl, and we've got no problem, we'll set you up. Doesn't matter what country you're in.
Yeah,
because we've got all countries effectively, even Pakistan and places like that.
Excellent. So go check out CI, the letter C. I, as in the letter I, method, M-E-T-H-O-D, cimethod.com. Go check that out. This has been so enlightening and informative. I think it's got something for helping people, whether they're struggling, helping people that are in existing business, learn and understand how to grow, and then helping everyone understand what to do now that they're making money. Once they're making money, how do I use this? What's the strategy? Because if you just stick it in a bank account, the purchasing power of your savings diminishes. So you ideally need to have different tiers, especially something that's liquid, you can convert to cash quickly, but you need to put it into something that is going to grow at minimum better than inflation. Yeah, otherwise, your money's just not worth what it's going to be worth tomorrow. And this is becoming more and more and more important in today's day and age. So go check out cimethod.com. Mark, is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
Not that I can think of, other than commit to spend the time to learn something and work through to get to the mastery level. That's the thing, is people tend to, I'm guilty of this as well, where I've started something and I get to a certain level of understanding or knowledge, and it can be in sports or anything, and then I'm happy with that, then I move on to something else. I think like investing is really a lifetime pursuit. So I think if you, my advice to everybody is that you need to learn how to invest. Choose your area. So if you're going to go equities, Buffett is the best one to follow. He's the most successful investor in history. He's built a $800 billion business from started off with $50,000. And basically, that's all been passive. So no one has done that. So he's the one to follow. What we've done is provide, we have a system to be able to help people implement that much more easily. But you still need to learn, and you need to learn about the businesses. You need to learn about management, incentives, alignment. There's a whole range of things you need to learn. And then also you need to learn about the financials as well so that you can actually make rational decisions. And then you need to be patient. And then you can really relax. It really is that easy. It's just not that hard. It needs to be an ongoing process. You don't say, I now know it all. Like when we started Team Invest, I thought I was a very good investor. I've been investing in shares for 40 years at that point, and I thought I was pretty smart. Now, I would describe myself as a middling investor. Yeah. And the reason is I'm 10,000% better than I was when we started Team Invest, but I didn't know what I didn't know. Now, I know a lot of things I don't know, and I know there's a lot of other stuff I don't know. So I'm quite humble in the I have no illusions about how good I am. I'm not, but I'm good enough to be able to build my compound my wealth as I've been talking about.
I love that.
I'm pretty average. I didn't even finish high school.
Yeah. So it doesn't, you don't need,
anybody can do it.
I love it. Mark, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us. Again, people go check out CIMethod.com. Thank you for coming and sharing with us. When you have your own audience, your own followers, your own clients, your own family, your grandkids that you could be spending time with. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience and I so we can all do a little bit better.
Excellent. Thank you, Darryl. It was great. I enjoyed it.